Blog Talk Radio.
You're starting.
Okay.
Mute. Says mute. Mute right there.
I'm not in anything.
No, right over here. Mute. Yeah.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning.
Who wants me lem bricks and old Bill Brown? Took the load of corn to town, and old Jim Dobbs, the ornery cuss, he just naturally followed us. As we drift past Sam Johnson's store, past the apps came out the door. When Jim, he stops to smell a box, they shied at him a bunch of rocks. Every time I come to town, the boys keep kicking my dog around. Makes no difference if he is a hound, they gotta quit kicking my dog around. They tied a tin can to his tail and run him past the county jail. And that plum naturally makes me sore, and Lem he cussed and Bill he swore. Me and Lem Briggs and old Bill Brown, we lost no time in a jumping down, and we wiped them ducks up on the ground for kicking my old dog around. Every time I come to town, the boys keep kicking my dog around. Makes no difference if he is a hound, they gotta quit kicking my dog around. Folks say a dog can't hold no grudge, but once when I got too much fudge, them sound ups tried to do me up, but they didn't count on old Jim Pup. Jim seed his duty far and thin, and he lit into them gentlemen, and he sure must up the coat-house squaw with rags and meat and hide and haw. Every time I come to town, the boys keep kicking my dog around. Makes no difference if he is a hound, they gotta quit kicking my dog around.
There you go, listeners. I'm sorry. We're having some technical difficulties.
We're
having some technical difficulties. But hey, here's Carl and Lamar. Carl and Lamar. Sorry, Carl. I'm very sorry, Carl. Go ahead.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Right. Hey. Okay, Lamar, are you on there?
Yeah, I'm here. What's good, Carl?
Okay. So Lamar's an old friend of IWOC. He was a founding member when they began drafting up the bylaws under the Industrial Workers of the World. And I first met Lamar, would have been around late July of 2014. And so we've been in touch ever since, and so we've got some interesting conversations over the years, and so I was wanting to talk about some of the philosophers that are influencing a lot of the prison writers that we're seeing coming out getting books printed, and but we can start anywhere you like, Lamar. And but so how you doing right now?
Oh, I'm feeling fantastic. I appreciate you. I'm saying it's a pleasure being on the podcast. You know, it's something that's not only necessary, in my opinion, but it's you know, it's also a great way, you know, to spend the evening, you know. And yeah, I'm feeling great. I appreciate you.
Well, that's great. Yeah, we intended on having the show early enough so we can catch people before they go out and maybe give them something to think about and look forward to on early Saturday evenings. And this will be our ninth show, Lamar. And so we're very excited to have you on. And because we had a request to get you back on when people heard you talk last month, and so, you know, we have our IWOC meetings and you usually catch one of those almost once a week whenever you get the chance, and we were just you know, our conversation was, you know, that what prison revolutionaries go through inside mass incarceration, and you know, there's a lot of people that read your notes and the stuff that you've published, and so it in some ways it's the same, maybe the same thing that any other author would come up against whenever they maybe go on a book tour and meet their audience and find out who their audience is. It's in some ways it's like it, almost any other novelist or author. But then again, there's this period, you know, where a lot of these books were written behind bars, which is significantly different than you know, the conditions, you know, the average novelist is almost a permanent vacation if they're a big enough writer. And
yeah.
So movement building begins with the prison authors and writers, I think it's important, you know, for people to understand that this, you know, there's a continuous line that we've seen over the last 50 years or 60 or 70 years even of the relationships between the writers and the readers inside the penitentiaries. And
yeah.
And so I mean it's new to a lot of our audience. Because they don't realize that there's authors from prison that do extensive tours, and like our friend Lorenzo, where he's getting up there in his 70s, and he went to Europe, and they had him booked double on a 30-day tour where he did like 60 engagements the last time he was in Europe.
Yeah.
And so you know, it's an international audience that reads prison literature, and so it's an interesting body of work, you know, when it comes to, you know, the humanities, when it comes to civil rights, and
yeah.
You know, because most people can recall Martin Luther King, you know, letter from Birmingham jail.
Yeah.
You know, they come, you know, or maybe some Malcolm X, but they all came out of the Enlightenment, the Enlightenment period, and so it was some of the 19th century authors or philosophers that were influencing a lot of these writers, and so that's what I wanted to ask you is we were talking. You mentioned somebody the other day, and I wanted to write it down, but it was like. You read there was a particular philosopher that you read that it turned the light on for as far as anti-authoritarian, and it was somebody that you wouldn't even think of necessarily being an anti-authoritarian type of person. Do you remember who that was?
You may be referring to, if memory serves me correctly, Alexander Berkman. If that's who you're referring to.
Yes.
Before I begin speaking on it briefly, I just want to add that, my writings, they're like, they're not just, like prison abolition and things like that. They're, there's a holistic vibration with it, where things such as houselessness, suicidal depression, whether in the street or in solitary confinement, things like self-hate, a lot of the poison that society has been injected with by the serum of systemic indoctrination. And I have writings that I have yet to even get typed out. I have, so many writings, that, from inside, from outside, and in regards to, like, you're right, like, it's like another world. A lot of people find themselves when, in places that are unacknowledged, so there's, Alexander Berkman, for example, in regard, and this isn't like finding, this is just in regards to people coming across such powerful ideology as that which Alexander Berkman and other important, conscientious, free-thinking rebels have determined to grace this world with the minds with, and the hearts of humanity with. Alexander Berkman, I first got introduced to Alexander Berkman. That was actually one of the first revolutionary pamphlets that I myself particularly received through South Chicago Anarchist Black Cross Boom Distro. Anthony Racine, upon written request for literature, sent me, substantial amount of literature while I was in solitary confinement. And Alexander Berkman, he published something called ABC of Anarchism. At first it was called, if I'm not mistaken, What is Anarchist Communism? Initially, if I'm not mistaken, and then it got renamed inevitably into ABC of Anarchism. And this is a powerful read when taken, contemplated on, and used in a practical way in everyday life. It deals with and he wrote this. This was back in, the early 1900s, in the early 20th century. He himself did time he did 14 years, if I'm not mistaken, in Pittsburgh for the alleged assassination attempt on a capitalist named Henry Clay Frick. And, you know, he wrote prison memoirs of an prison memoirs of an anarchist or something like that. He wrote a book on of memoirs as well. You know, that is also powerful. So he, you know, he was locked up as well. And you know, when you're locked up, you know, there's a certain dichotomy. You know, there's a lot of people who commit suicide, you know, and then there's and a lot of people who commit suicide are people who have no or who lack sufficient mental resources, you know, and you know, it's done on purpose. You know, the way that there's a lot of banned books. His ABC of anarchism I saw in the banned book list when I was at prison I was in. It was like 3 books. I just found out my book, The Deprived and Depraved, and 2 of my other writings are banned in all Florida prisons. I just found out looking up on the internet, looking up my name on the internet, and you know, Rashi Lamar, like, come find out, you know. So there's this ideological repression that's going on now, and they know that, you know, the those who wage psychological warfare on the masses, and particularly when it's solitary, you know, in prison behind lock and key and things like that, you know, they don't want people to become enlightened. You know, on ABC, like you mentioned, enlightenment, you know, and in regards to like and Brother Lorenzo, a powerful thinker, powerful body, beautiful human being, articulate mind, conscientious, revolutionary, anarchist, black anarchist, beautiful brother, you know, and, you know, his, you know, his writings, you know, a lot of his writings, are banned, you know, in different places as well, you know, and, and I consider that as like kind of like a black enlightenment, so to speak, like that 60s, you know, that era, and you know, the black power era and all that, mm-hmm. You know, what people call the black power era, you know, so it's kind of, you know, like a black enlightenment in a lot of ways. Every person has their own ages within them, you know. And some people stay stuck due to the glue of stagnation of literature, the inability to possess things that help individuals evolve, you know. And this is a very serious thing. This is like, you know, behind lock and key, where you have at any given time 60,000 people in solitary confinement. You know, that's an army, you know, that's an army of, you know, a potential army right there you know, people who can turn into freedom fighters and conscientious human beings, you know. So, Alexander Berkman, to get back, you know, he was a remarkable individual, and his ABC is anarchism. As a philosophy, anarchism is more than a philosophy to me. It's it's an autonomous declaration, you know, in life that we can live. You know, first we start off reading. We start off reading chapters and stuff like that, and this mind-blowing stuff, you know, this, what is anarchist communism, and, you know, chapters like that, and on production, and, you know, the power of, you know, General Strike, which he talks about, is the social revolution, you know, essentially, you know, and having thinking of these things, when people try to wonder, like, you know, when people wonder and try to figure out ways, like, well, how can we move from point A to point B, you know, and how can a revolution be raised where we can just, you know, end this madness of having to pay for the things that our class produces, and, you know, the legalized extortion of taxes and psychological subserviency to other people, you know. When we read about these things, you know, we begin to realize, like, you know, after a while, when we internalize it enough, when we get a chance to, you know, internalize it, you know, it liberates us, you know, from the confines of material conditions. We become like radioactive, and when that happens, it's a wrap. You know, people get out. You know, first people, you know, my next door neighbor, you know, they had him drinking out the toilet, you know, and they cut his water off. You know, he was like the second prisoner that I knew. He was the second prisoner who I personally met, you know, who they cut the water off for so many days that, you know, he resorted to drinking, you know, out of the toilet, you know. And of course, these are things that aren't highlighted in the New York Times or, you know, you know, media and stuff like that, you know, contemporary, well, and, you know, public media, you know, public media and all that. So, but, so yeah, Alexander Berkman is definitely a powerful philosopher, and his life was a living philosophy, a revolutionary philosophy, you know. And you know, when he died, you know, up to when he died, he was ironically selfless. You know, he, you know, since, you know, he committed suicide, he was going through so much physical pain that, you know, he was in bed, and Emma Goldman, who was, you know, another powerful orator and freedom-fighting anarchist and feminist, and just really remarkable human being. You know, she was free inside, you know. You know, she was tending to him. That was, you know, that was one of her longtime lovers, you know. And she didn't even know that he was, you know, that he was gonna, that he shot himself. You know, he shot himself in the chest and his leg, you know, when she went into the other room. You know, that's how much, like, how much he cared about not putting, you know, someone that was that close to him to worry, or like to be, you know, he was just phenomenal, you know. And so, you know, that selflessness, you know, that selflessness somehow has a way of characteristically showing just how much someone has it together, you know, where how much of a genuine self, like not just genuine, but how much of a complete human being, how much at one someone can be with themselves, you know, where they up to the very hour of death, you know, be as consistent
okay.
as they can. Yep.
Yeah, let's we're going to take a break. We're at the 30-minute mark on our show, and I want to ask Mike to play a little music, and we'll get a 3-minute break. We're talking about Alexander Berkman with Hibachi Lamar, a founder of Incarcerated Worker Organizing Committee, a chair of the Industrial Workers of the World, and go ahead and fade in some music that you got queued up there, Mike.
Some decent sounds, too. I like the music.
Okay, we're going to break for some music, and then we'll be back with Hibachi Lamar.
All right.
Sadara Davis spent hundreds of dollars every month to talk to her fiancé, Johnson Davis, on the phone, even though he has spent the last few months incarcerated in Nelson Coleman Correctional Center in St. Charles Parish, Louisiana, and each call runs about $5. But then Hurricane Ida made landfall on August 29th. That afternoon on the phone with him, Davis said she heard what sounded like the wind taking the roof off. The top of the jail of St. Charles Parish was flooding, and winds touching 100 miles an hour ripped through the neighborhoods bordering the Mississippi River. Although the parish was under a mandatory evacuation order, Johnson and more than 300 other inmates were left at the facility. I was like, you know, under mandatory evacuation, Davis recalled saying. He responded basically with, these people aren't worried about us. Within minutes of Ida reaching St. Charles, the jail lost power and running water. Davis, who lives more than 2 hours away in Lafayette, was worried about her fiancé, but couldn't get any information from the sheriff's office in charge of the facility. Ida, a fast-moving storm that turned into a hurricane in 3 days after forming, tested local governments' emergency response plans. Some areas, like New Orleans, told residents to shelter in place, whereas towns and neighboring parishes were under evacuation order. But Davis isn't alone in thinking that officials neglected incarcerated people. More than a dozen civil rights groups have raised questions about why some detention facilities in Hurricane Ida's path weren't evacuated before the storm. Louisiana is known for getting battered by hurricanes. It also puts more of its citizens behind bars than any other state in the U.S., with 1,094 of every 100,000 residents behind bars. If the state were a country, it would have the highest incarceration rate in the world, 1.6 times higher than the United States. Unlike those on the outside, people inside of prisons depend entirely on jail officials and local governments to keep them safe during a natural disaster. But there is no coordinated or mandated system to manage prisoners during these kinds of events. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, Louisiana also has the highest in-custody mortality rate. The coronavirus pandemic has made this much worse. At one point last year, 40% of the state's inmates had tested positive for COVID-19. The health risks are heightened by the prevalence of pretrial detainment, in which, like Johnson, are sometimes incarcerated for months without ever being convicted of a crime. The lack of coordinated plan for jails leaves more than 50,000 incarcerated people in Louisiana facing elevated threats from natural disasters. With patchwork efforts for ensuring prison conditions are livable after the initial danger subsides, these risks have long been known. In 2005, following Hurricane Katrina, a reported 7,000 prisoners went days without electricity, trapped in cells filled chest high with sewage water. When we think about people who are incarcerated on the front lines of climate change, there's deliberate structural reasons behind this. Detention facilities are where government authority is at its highest of individual power and is at the lowest. there are no statewide guidelines for protecting incarcerated people during disasters in Louisiana. More than 130 detention centers. Those in charge of the facilities, county governments, sheriffs, and the State Department of Public Safety and Corrections to come up with their own emergency response plan. As a result, activists say disasters tend to linger longer inside prisons than outside of them. The most loss of life doesn't occur during the storm itself, but the days following, when people have no access to drinking water, electricity, or sometimes food. In the week after Ida hit southern Louisiana, the Nelson Coleman Correction Center phone system was shut down for days, and Davis said the sheriffs didn't respond to any of the emails she sent from four different accounts. Unable to find answers online, Davis made the trek from Lafayette to the jail, 30 miles outside of New Orleans. She had recently found out that their four-month-old child was prone to seizures and wanted to hear Johnson tell her that everything would be okay. But when she made it to the jail, she said she was turned away immediately and given no information. Officials from St. Charles Parish, who have jurisdiction over the jail, did not respond for comment, but St. Charles Parish Sheriff Greg Champagne publicly said inmates weren't evacuated because $28 million facility construction in 2001 was built to withstand a Category 5 hurricane. Yet Davis advocates and others in touch with those incarcerated at the facility, they heard the building has had flooding and rolling power outages. A mandatory evacuation order was issued, but no evacuation was implemented for roughly 600 people locked up in LaForche Parish Detention Center. On August 30th, the day after the storm first hit the jail, which sustained damage and loss of power, made news for posting video footage of inmates, some of them who were reportedly detained pre-trial, filling up sandbags to protect property across the parish against flooding in Baton Rouge. Young people detained at a city-run juvenile detention center were not evacuated from the facility, and the center lost power for a day and a half. It wasn't much better for facilities that did evacuate. Inmates in New Orleans Parish and Plaquemine Parish were moved north of Baton Rouge to the Louisiana State Penitentiary, known as Angola. But an outdated inmate search system prevented their family members from knowing about it. Once inmates were moved back to their prospective county jail, local sheriffs opted to impose mandatory quarantines rather than letting people go through routine COVID tests. This meant they couldn't have visitors or go inside for at least another 2 weeks. Young people lucky enough to be evacuated, like those at the Youth Study Center and Detention Center in New Orleans, were moved to adult facilities, an action that Louisiana public defenders have argued as illegal. Other activists argue that the entire system needs an overhaul. A better framework, they say, could take on two problems at once, climate change and mass incarceration. Revamping sentencing laws they consider outdated and racist would reduce the state prison population, save money, and make evacuation easier. For those incarcerated ahead of their trials, advocates have suggested allowing them to evacuate or shelter with their families since they have not yet been convicted of a crime.
Democracy, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the general population has to be kept from interfering. They can be spectators, but not participants.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do.
Spectators, but not participants.
It's time to talk about censorship.
This song to 20 people.
But isn't it silly?
At your name, don't break the cycle.
From people to people.
Pass it along.
People like MP3s.
Pass it along.
How about trying this future on for size?
Spectators, but not participants.
But it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
You can't legislate people's behavior.
We do what we want to do, you know. If they consider that selling out, then Napster should be in prison.
It's time to talk about censorship.
Send this song to 20 people.
But isn't it silly?
At your name, don't break the cycle.
From people to people.
Pass it along.
People like MP3s.
Pass it along.
Want to download music for free.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do. People are going to do what they want to do.
How about trying this future on for size?
Well, it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants. Spectators, but not participants.
You can't legislate people's behavior.
We don't mind when our fans pay money to wear our promotional t-shirts. And it's fine when they pay $40 to come to one of our concerts. But when our fans think they can listen to our music for free, they just cross the line.
Okay, we're back. We're back with Lamar Hibachi. We're talking about Alexander Bergman and Emma Goldman. Go ahead, Lamar. Tell us about Emma Goldman.
All right. Well, Emma Goldman, you know, she was another powerful, free-thinking, conscientious, enigmatic, anarchist, feminist, orator, writer, freedom fighter. Just she was remarkable. You know, she was like I was mentioning in the green room, she was like a household name back then, and whereas like now, like a lot of people don't really know too much about her or anything like that unless, you know, you listen to podcasts like this, you know, or come across the someone put you on, you know. But she was remarkable, you know, and she was a lover of, of Bergman, you know, for many years, and you know, she did time on, in New York, you know, for. I think she did like a year or something on like Blackwell Island or something like that for saying something like if you're hungry, you know, ask for food, you know. If they don't give you food, you know, ask for work. You know, if they don't give you bread, ask for work so you get bread. If they don't give you work, take bread. You know what I'm saying? You know, uh-huh. And that's something that, you know, that's something that actually Tupac, you know, a rapper, you know, from the 1990s, you know, echoed, and, you know, a lot of people don't realize, like, a lot of things even the rappers, you know, be saying are, you know, things that anarchists such as Emma Goldman articulated to the world, you know, before our generations, you know. So, you know, such as that, or like Emiliano Zapata, you know what I'm saying, and from Mexico, you know, the anarchists who said, it's better to die on my feet than to live on my knees, you know. And, you know, so these are, like, remarkable thinkers that that a lot of people may not even realize, you know, have strong, deeply entrenched anarchist roots. You know, and Emma G, you know, she was, you know, I visited her grave site, you know, not far, it's like in the outskirts of Chicago, you know, and her grave site's there, Lucy T, you know, the sister, you know, she was another anarchist and co-founder of the IWW, you know, 1905, I think July 7th. And she, you know, she was another, like, remarkable figure, you know, like, this was big, you know.
Uh-huh.
Got a, one of my comrades, you know, Gail Aaron, who I know personally, you know, I will regret, you know, but, you know, we, she put out a book, you know, called Freedom, Equality, Solidarity, you know, a book on Lucy Parsons, you know, so, and it was like, you know, it was very, very positive read, you know, of her writing, you know, and, but yeah, Emma G, she, they some of her tombstone too, because the date she died in 1940, and I think on the, gravestone, I think it says 1939. I remember seeing that and noticing it. That's something that I don't know if anyone else has really, too many other people have taken notice to, but that's something that, in my opinion, should be rectified. You know, but yeah, she was, you know, she was dynamic. You know, people could, you could YouTube Emma Goldman, you'll come across like rare snippet or two or something, you know, and, cause this is back in like the early 1900s, you know, and she was like fierce and fearless and just like, you know, she was the type of person who, you know, where you would trust the kids around and stuff like that, you know, like the kid or something where you're, you know, you know, as opposed to like a, you know, correctional officer or something, or, you know, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. it's like something totally radically, you know, different, you know, and she was, you know, yeah, she was remarkable. Yep.
And Lucy, you mentioned Lucy Parsons, because this, the Haymarket event was, that was like the Hiroshima of labor.
Yeah.
That.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And Lucy Parsons' husband was executed for that.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
And so every May Day we celebrate the Haymarket Martyrs still.
Right on.
And she's buried next to Emma Goldman, and I remember talking to the caretaker at the cemetery, and they said that people, they were cutting paths all over the place to find the graves of these labor martyrs and heroes, and so they just put the headstones right there below Emma Goldman. Do you remember that story?
I'm not too familiar with that particular story, you know, but I know like her plot's like right around the corner, like probably like not even a 7-second walk, you know, and you know, yeah, like her, Lucy, she was a, you know, they called the Chicago police dubbed her more, quote unquote, more dangerous than 1,000 rioters, you know, like If somebody's interested in listening to the reason why, all somebody has to do is just check her out. Somebody could, you could go on YouTube and they have a, she wrote a piece called, what is it?
Okay, so we're talking about Lucy Parsons here. She was born a slave in Texas, and she meets her husband, Aldous.
Albert, yep.
Albert.
Mm-hmm.
Albert Parsons.
Yeah.
And so they're in Chicago, and it's an amazing time. The 1890s, there was the Pullman strike.
Mm-hmm.
There had been a railroad strike about 10 years earlier that shut down half the country, and it was the fight for the 8-hour day.
Yeah.
It struck mm-hmm. such a blow. People don't realize that it struck a blow against the capitalist.
Yeah.
And it took World War One for them to recoup their losses. And the capitalists mm-hmm. The capitalists were willing to kill off half the world population at a blink of an eye.
It's crazy.
Yeah, but I mean, when we're looking at 50% of the labor force in places like Spain and Lithuania and the Ukraine, I mean, it's devastating. But we don't even, the Mexican Revolution of 1904, that was the first proletariat revolution on the planet, 12 years before the Russian Revolution. But you don't hear this, but you mentioned Zapata, and the Magone brothers were there, and
mm-hmm.
so we hear a little, we might hear a little bit about the Mexican Revolution, but the proletariat movement was strong here in by the 1880s, 20 years after the Civil
mm-hmm.
War. I feel we can't spend enough time talking about this period leading up to World War One, because we're in a very similar situation today as we were 115 years ago.
The Haymarket anarchists, the Haymarket martyrs, as they're also known as, they were phenomenal. They were was this count time?
Let's see. All right. So that was about 1894.
I wasn't meaning the count of the I'm in the facility, so they come around and they make their rounds. They're like count time. But they passed. So yeah, that's why I got quiet right quick. But yeah, they were fierce, and they. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
It's interesting. This
mm-hmm.
Because there was like the Pullman porters. That was one of the first strikes, and that was one of the few occupations that black men could have a career in. And so you had like W.E.B. Du Bois saying, we can't segregate. The labor cannot be segregated. I mean, this is one thing that was determined mm-hmm. that brought out from the Civil War. The fight to end wage slavery is never more important than it is today.
Yes, yeah, it's really important. We see it how much more and more important it is. With the facade, for example, of we're raising the minimum wage, but like the insurrectionist anarchist Luigi Galliani spoke of, the iron law of wages. He was another philosopher who, not only inspired, people like me now reading, but also golden age anarchists, Sacco and Vanzetti. He was their mentor. They were their teacher. They drank from the fountain of his wisdom, And this is, again, back in the early 1900s. So, yeah, and he talked about the iron law of wages, you know, where, you know, they raise the wages and everything. But then so it's a facade because the cost of living goes up as well, you know. So it's like it's a facade, you know. It's like a hustle, you know, and they hustle in with people's minds and stuff like that. And a lot of people fall for it. A lot of people think that, oh, well, what can we do anyway? How are we going to go against the freaking government or something like that? You know what I'm saying? And, you know, so, you know, that was like the, like, strong propaganda of the deed era right there. There was, like, there was a whole lot of stuff going on there, like, you know, from Pittsburgh to Boston to all around the world when Sacco and Vanzetti was, you know, about to get executed, you know. It was strikes going on everywhere that was, like, really crushing the system, you know, economically, you know. So, yeah, the iron law of wages, like, you know, so these are important philosophers. These are important. These are socioeconomic, not only theoreticians, but deep thinkers and revolutionaries who not only advocated the propaganda by deed, you know, but and you know, Berkman, you know, he was like he said in ABC of Anarchism, you know, you know, we're no pacifists, you know. But, you know, we fight, we make sure we know what we're fighting for at the same time, you know. And, you know, while he believed in, you know, defense, obviously, like any other creature that, you know, or person that, you know, values life as well as, you know, including their own, you know, would embrace, you know, he also embraced a syndicalism as well, in the sense like that, the anarchist communism, the anarchist communism, not dictatorial party led communism. That's a different type of, you know, that's authoritarian. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so this is different. This is, you know, libertarian communism, not party libertarian. Like, see, the system it takes a lot of the things from the movement and then capitalizes on them, you know, capitalizes on the movement. For example, the Free Breakfast for Children program, you know, but the Panthers started up, you know. Now we have free lunch programs. That started with the Panthers Free Breakfast for Children program. You know what I'm saying? You know, uh-huh. So a lot of people don't know that. A lot of people say, oh, get a free lunch. Oh, you know, the government, like, you know, the very people who implemented, you know, this these necessary programs for the kids, you know, was the very ones and a part of the very organization that the system that, the, you know, deemed as the most, you know, like, you know, the most, the number one threat to the, you know, internal security, you know, of the country, of the government, you know. So it's, they take things, put it to their own twist, and then don't want the people to know about, you know, these things. Because just imagine if, you know, people read, you know, Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman in social studies, you know, and Lorenzo Kamboa Irvin, you know, with, you know, if people's minds would be thinking about not capitalizing on people, would be thinking of not big fish eat little fish, and it's a dog eat dog world. And just imagine the eradication of current violent dangerous cliches that we see, you know, pervading society, that we hear pervading society right now, you know. So, you know, it's so yeah, these are deep thinkers, you know, Fred Hampton and, you know, just so many deep thinkers. But yeah, Alexander Berkman, and Emma Goldman, and you know, these were like really powerful spirits. You know, not powerful in a coercive way, which makes them, you know, empowering to the people, because you know people are empowered when their power is not taken from them, you know. So. you know, and when people learn how to exercise it in a way that produces, you know, like Bertman talked about in ABC and Anarchism, for example, he mentioned about loaves of bread, you know, and he talked about how, I don't have, you know, his material right in front of me right at the moment, but, you know, we spoke of like bread, loaves of bread, like if you, there's like, I forget exactly how he termed it, but it was like if you have a certain amount of bread, like take, for example, and this is just my, what I'm saying, because I don't remember the words verbatim, and I don't have the, which he was like, take, for example, if you have like a loaf of, if there's like six people and, 12 loaves of bread, you know, the price is going to be lower than it would be if there was, six people and three loaves of bread, you know, and, that's what's known as, you know, supply and demand, you know, and he talks about how, how there's no value, like a thing has no value, you know, it's like there's, the system puts labels on things and values and things like that, that is really like, you know, they just make it up. You know what I'm saying? Whatever they want to, you know, like, oh, okay. Just like when you go to the stove, you know what I'm saying? Like a pack of squares, like a pack of cigarettes or whatever costs, $9 at one store. And then you go to another store, it's like 14, you know? So it's like, you know, a thing can't, you know, so that's when he gets into, you know, he talks about the importance of, anarchist communism, where everybody works together, where, you know, the classes, you know, not like a dictator, like when, like Lorenzo, for example, like he was, like Lorenzo talked about in, or like I talked about it in Lorenzo's Anarchism in the Black Revolution. I think it's maybe in the, like about the author section, like in the back or something, and like the second or first volume where he talks about, where it talks about how he was in Czechoslovakia and stuff like that, and he was like disillusioned with state socialism, you know, there's different forms of socialism, you know, there's state socialism, then you have, you know, libertarian socialism, where there's no dictator, and everybody collectively, you know, how like there's collectives now, work together, and, blow up together, not blow up like violently, but have a, more resources available to each person with everybody, you know, working together.
Well, thank you for coming on, Lamar. And we were talking about Alexander Berkman. And we appreciate you.
I simply had a ball.
Oh, you sweet thing, I cannot have much, for you are really such a sweet thing. Although it's that one word perfection, fit you to a D. Speaking of perfection, you're the whole confectionery. Oh, you sweet thing, so sweet you take my breath. I could love you to death, you sweet thing.